Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this Sunday, October 12th, 2008, just 3.5 weeks before the 2008 presidential election and congressional elections as well. With all the to-do about the financial collapse and the impending economic recession and or depression, there's a lot of talk about what the next administration is going to have to do. Our guest today has written a book exactly on this subject, Robert Kuttner, author of Obama's Challenge, just published, just written. Will be here to join us for the full hour. But first, before we go to Robert Kuttner, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Public access educational and governmental television, or PEG stations, are local TV channels that broadcast programming as diverse as the communities they are based in, ranging from local music videos to city council meetings to community sporting events and a whole lot in between. But the people who make PEG stations a reality have been facing a number of challenges over the past 2 years, including new state laws and FCC regulations, which have been detrimental to PEG access centers and programming across the country. Last month, a congressional committee held a hearing on the impact of these new rules. Barbara Popovich, executive director of Chicago Access Network Television, or CAN-TV, and member of the Alliance for Community Media, testified at the hearing.
The question at hand was, has localism and diversity been set aside? This is what Representative Serrano, the chair, kept saying. Has this been set aside in the interest of ushering more competition into the marketplace? And I would say the answer to that is decidedly yes.
A sizable portion of the hearing was spent discussing the impact of AT&T's video service, UVerse, on PEG channels. Popovich explains that since UVerse is delivered using new digital technology, it should have even more flexibility than cable to offer the kind of benefits that viewers have come to expect, such as faster channel changes and instant information about programming. But PEG actually doesn't benefit in ways you might expect.
None of that applies to PEG access, which does not carry closed captioning, no second audio programming. You cannot channel surf between commercial and PEG channels. You basically have a reduced quality because you're looking at a smaller screen. It's like an internet, and it takes time for that application to load. So what this says is that here's a corporation that has made the business decision that the public, the educational institutions, the local governments do not count.
Popovich believes that active citizens in each community can impact the policy decisions that shape our media system, including those regarding community media.
And I think it's important to tell your public officials at the local, state, and federal level, as well as any discourse that you have with the campaigns for our presidential candidates, that it is important to preserve public media like PEG access, community radio. It's very important that we have information at the local level and that policies must follow and protections must be put in place to be sure this exists for the local community.
For more information on the fight to protect PEG access, go to keepusconnected.org.
And now, a commentary by Free Press blogger Megan Tatey.
My dad called me recently from his home in Oklahoma City, aghast. I'd been telling him about the problem of the digital divide, but it's hard for him to understand when he can jump online in a matter of seconds. But something he heard on local radio stunned him. A woman called in and told the host she didn't have internet access where she lived outside the city. She was hoping to get more information about Republican presidential candidate John McCain. According to my dad, she said, "Now I hear John McCain was in a war. Does that mean he's going to be a war president?" Sure, you don't need the internet to learn the basics of McCain's biography. But tens of millions of Americans do not have the equal ability to educate themselves about this crucial election. Half of the population can easily access newspapers and magazines from across the country and around the world to find a variety of opinions about the candidates. They can watch videos of stump speeches, read a blog post about the merits of a candidate's stance on an issue, or do their own investigation into campaign contributions. The other half must rely on what the mainstream media decide to offer viewers and readers for political coverage. The digital divide isn't just about relegating people to slow email. It's about thwarting people's civic engagement, preempting their cultural participation, and ultimately stifling democratic action. Presidential contenders Barack Obama and John McCain have been debating on national TV. Viewers with broadband don't have to rely on just the moderators and pundits. They can use their internet connection to research the facts and the fiction. But once again, the other half of the population will be hamstrung, only able to get the spin they are being fed by the networks. The next president must adopt policy that rolls out open, affordable, high-speed internet access to all Americans. It is essential that every American has equal and open access to the internet in order to fully participate in elections and in our democracy. Here's a first step. Perhaps one of the debate moderators could ask the next president, how will you bring a universal, affordable broadband to all Americans?
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL, AM 580, beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is Robert Kuttner, who is the co-founder and current editor-in-chief of the American Prospect, and who's also a member of the board of directors of, or a distinguished senior fellow, excuse me, of DEMOS, a nonpartisan public policy center. But we have him here today primarily as the author of the brand new book, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. And I don't think I've ever had a more timely guest in the 5.5 or 6 year history of Media Matters than Robert Kuttner. Mr. Kuttner, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
We had you on this show, as you may recall, almost a year ago, talking about your last book, which dealt with similar issues, but it sort of has, we've come more than, a long way in the past year. Why don't you first state, you know, why you wrote the book, what the basic argument of your book is, and then give your assessment of the nature of the economic crisis we're in.
Well, as you mentioned, a year ago I wrote a book called The Squandering of America, and I was warning that the economy was heading for a 1929 scale crash because of all the abuses of deregulation. And after I wrote that book, it occurred to me that the president who took office in January of 2009 was going to face quite a crisis. And I started looking more closely at the Democratic field. Conventionally, Obama was kind of the more centrist certainly himself and Hillary, and if you counted Edwards, Edwards was the most progressive of the three. But I think nonetheless, a lot of people like me concluded that because of his history, because of his character, because of his power to inspire, that of the three of them, Obama was the one who was capable of real greatness in a crisis. And so I decided to write this book about what Obama would face and why he would have to be a more radical president than he has been a candidate, and why I think he has it in him to be that president. And, you know, to sum up the book in a sentence, he will have to be Roosevelt or he will be Hoover. And the crisis is far and away the most serious thing we face since 1929. In some ways, it's more serious because if you think about it, in 1929, you had a stock market crash, which only gradually spread to the banking sector and to the real economy. Things were not too bad in 1930, 1931. The big wave of bank collapses did not come until 1932. This is unraveling at a much faster rate because it started in the credit sector and spread to the rest of the economy, and the credit sector is the heart of capitalism. So my other point is that Obama, unlike Roosevelt and Hoover, who had a five-month interregnum after the election of 1932 and didn't want anything to do with each other, he's going to have to hit the ground running November 5th, and he's going to have to appeal to Bush's patriotism and Bush's desire to at least go out on a grace note and point the country in the direction that will get us out of this crisis, and I'm happy to tell you what I think that is, if you like.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the book is all about precisely what the program you think Obama should pursue to become a great and transformative president rather than a failed president. Our guest, Robert Kuttner, author of the brand new book, Obama's Challenge. And as I was reading this over the past week, Robert Kuttner, you know, I was struck with how timely it is. It's almost prescient how, I know you finished this in July or August, I'm not sure when, but it seems that you anticipated in an eerie manner the events of the past 3 weeks.
I feel like the dog who chased the car and surprised himself to catch the car. I was working with a very unusual publisher, a small publishing house called Chelsea Green, which specializes in getting out timely books very, very quickly. And I was still working on the book the first week in August, and we had books at the Democratic Convention the last week in August. So that was something of a miracle. What I did in researching the book was I went back and I did a lot of reading, not only on the Great Depression, but on the great presidents. And what I concluded was that if you look at Lincoln and Roosevelt and the Johnson of the Civil Rights era before he messed it up with the Vietnam War, each one faced a crisis and turned that crisis to an opportunity. In each case, the president was able to transform public opinion and transform himself, really, by seizing a moment and rising to the occasion. So that in the case of Lincoln, he takes office hoping to hold together the Union, but within less than 3 years, he's issued the Emancipation Proclamation, something that was deemed inconceivable in 1861. Roosevelt ran on a balanced budget platform. He criticized Hoover from the right. He was against deposit insurance. He was against large-scale public works. And it took him about 2 weeks once he took office to appreciate just how dire the situation was and how radical the medicine needed to be. And, of course, Johnson, succeeding Kennedy, decides in that moment that his legacy is going to be to redeem the promises of Lincoln and be the president who finally brings blacks into full citizenship rights, and damned if he didn't succeed. So in each case, by the way, you had a president working with and animating and sometimes being a little frightened of social movements who were inspired by the president to believe that radical change was possible, and then, as they got more mobilized, pushed the president to be even more radical. So you had this funny relationship of Lincoln and the abolitionists who were constantly pushing him to move faster, and Lincoln deciding that he could only move as fast as he could take the country with him. You had the industrial labor movement both pushing Johnson from the left, Roosevelt from the left, but also being able to say, mostly truthfully, President Roosevelt wants you to join the Union. And then, of course, you had Johnson's remarkable relationship with Dr. King. So I think the lesson, one lesson, and there's a whole other set of lessons having to do with the economic crisis, one lesson for Obama is to rekindle the belief on the part of people that transformative change is possible and then to rise to the moment.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Robert Kuttner, author of the brand new book, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. And when I say a newly released book, I mean newly released. This book just finished, as Robert Kuttner just said, 6 weeks, 2 months ago at most. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Robert Kuttner today, the telephone number at Media Matters is 333-9455. We're having some troubles with our toll-free line today, so we're going to have to not use that. So if you're calling from out of the area, the area code here is 217, so 333-9455. The phone lines are open. Robert Kuttner, you know, you've, I think, pegged, as the SEC has and nearly every economist I'm familiar with has, the source of much of the problems of the financial crisis with deregulation, lax and incompetent regulation when it did exist also. Recently, I've been seeing messages from the Republican Party talking about the current financial crisis, saying that it is largely due to pressure by liberal Democrats to force bankers to issue bad loans to risky poor people. Mm-hmm. And this apparently is gaining a certain amount of traction, at least among the base of the party. I had never heard economics like that before this last week. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I just wrote the editorial for the next issue of the American Prospect, which will be out in a couple of weeks, and I call my editorial Battle of the Narratives. So let's assume you're the Republican Party, and your whole ideology that markets can do no wrong has come crashing down along with the stock market. For 30 years, the Republican story has been that if you just get out of the way and let Wall Street invent whatever it can dream up, markets will discipline themselves. Well, nobody believes that anymore. I mean, you have the Republican Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, who came to town with an agenda of even further deregulation. Now he wants to nationalize the banks. So, you know, you have to pinch yourself. He's sounding like François Mitterrand. And things that were inconceivably radical a month ago will be barely adequate. That's how much of a transformation there's been in economics. So if you're the Republican Party and you need some kind of alibi, what do you come up with? And they've come up with two things. One of them, by another eerie coincidence, was a piece of legislation that I happened to write when I was the chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee under William Proxmire, great progressive senator. And it was a 1977 law called the Community Reinvestment Act. And this was in the era when redlining was a very serious problem. And we came up with the idea that because banks got charters from the government to serve their communities, it wasn't fair play if they just siphoned savings out of communities. They had to give something back. And so we said, banks have an obligation to serve the credit needs of their communities consistent with sound lending standards. I want to italicize and underscore that. Consistent with sound lending standards. And so the right wing is blaming the Community Reinvestment Act, which is really a hoot because only federally regulated banks are covered by the Community Reinvestment Act, and almost all of the subprime lending was done by unregulated storefront mortgage companies, which have a license from the state, which get no supervision, which do not take deposits, which are simply brokers who sell off this stuff in the secondary market. And so Community Reinvestment Act had nothing to do with the meltdown. The other thing you hear is that Fannie Mae did it, and that Fannie Mae was in bed with Democrats.
Yeah, Bernie Frank basically was the sponsor of all the problems over there.
Who was?
Bernie Frank is laid blamed by the Republicans.
Well, the guy they have tried to finger is a guy named Frank Raines, who, by another coincidence, is also African-American, who was the head of Fannie Mae during the 1990s when Fannie Mae really started growing. This is a rather more complicated story. Fannie Mae, because it is government-sponsored and still has underwriting standards, did not throw away the rule book the way subprime lenders did. Fannie Mae did buy, and Fannie Mae is what is called a secondary market institution. It doesn't make loans directly. It buys loans from banks. Fannie Mae did buy what is called Alt-A loans, and these are loans that are not quite as good as standard loans because the documentation of someone's credit history or income history is not as good. And this middle kind of loan did contribute in a secondary way to the problems. But the primary cause was, number one, deregulation, not just of subprime, but in general, the ability of Wall Street to invent all kinds of exotic securities that nobody understood, not the regulators, not the people who bought them, not even the people who originated them, who got rich on the fees, with no regulatory supervision whatever. And there's another little story worth telling. 1994, the Congress, then in Democratic hands, started seeing some abuses in local mortgage lending, predatory lending, and they passed a law called the Home Equity, Homeownership, H-O-E-P-A, Homeownership Equity Protection Act, otherwise known as HOEPA, or HOPA. And this law said that even if you are unregulated by the federal government for other intents and purposes, you have to use normal, prudent underwriting standards in your mortgage lending. If that law had been enforced, there would have been no subprime crisis, but the Federal Reserve was directed to issue regulations. Alan Greenspan said, I don't think these are necessary, I'm not going to do it. And before Congress could hold hearings to hold Greenspan's feet to the fire, the Republicans took control of Congress in the 1994 mm-hmm. elections. There was another bit of scamming that went on. You all remember Enron. One of the things that Enron got into was an obscure kind of derivative called credit default swaps. And Phil Gramm, then the senior senator from Texas, a Republican, now a senior advisor to McCain, sneaked a provision into a bill prohibiting the federal government from regulating credit default swaps. Now, what these are is a kind of insurance against bonds going bad. So if you have a very hard-to-fathom bond backed by subprime mortgages, that's a kind of a derivative. And then an insurance company will write an insurance policy against the risk of that bond going bad. That's called a credit default swap. You have a derivative on top of derivative. It's like a Ponzi scheme. And it was this category of insurance policy, regulated by nobody, that took down the world's biggest insurance company, the conglomerate AIG, and required an $85 billion bailout by the government that's now just grown to $110 billion bailout. And so there is story after story after story about how it was deregulation that led to this. So you have one little bit of pro-consumer legislation that actually helps some moderate-income homeowners get mortgages for the first time, the Community Reinvestment Act, and the Republicans are blaming the whole thing on that. It's a joke.
Our guest today, Robert Kuttner, the editor of The American Prospect and author of the brand-new book, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Robert Kuttner, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number down, so if you're calling from out of the area, please use the area code 217-333-9455. Let's go to the phone line right now. Line 4, cell phone, you're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Yeah, thank you. Well, everything your guest just said makes sense. I believe it. But I got to tell you, the vast majority of people in America wouldn't understand a bit of that. I could barely follow it, and I'm fairly educated. But that's not really important. You approached it early on in your introduction. If there's not a mass movement in this country that involves millions of people demanding that somebody do something about the rich in this country, it's not going to change. I have the highest hopes for Obama, but, you know, I hate to praise the Clintons because I didn't care for them much, but early on in their term, Hillary got up and said, aren't out in the streets demanding health care, we're not going to get universal care. Well, sure enough, they get universal care. Until we get, and the problem is the Democrats are as allergic to mass movements as the Republicans are. There's every reason to believe that they will discourage that, the very thing that is needed
for change in this country. So I think a lot of fine-tuning here isn't going to do it.
All right.
More than that.
Thank you very much, caller. I think we've lost your cell phone connection, but I gather you heard the gist of that, Robert Kuttner?
Absolutely. Well, let's not forget, I mean, Barack Obama was a community organizer, and I don't think he's allergic to mass movements. He certainly studied the civil rights movement. You, as clever an inside player as Lyndon Johnson was, Lyndon Johnson would have not succeeded in enacting the Civil Rights Act without the heroism of Martin Luther King and the whole movement behind him. And I think when you have a president who signals the possibility of radical change, that restores some flesh and blood to civic life. And I think we're going to see a flowering of activism. I can't predict what form it's going to take. I think we're going to see a resurgence of the labor movement, for starters, particularly if we get the Employee Free Choice Act. And a lot of kids, young people, have been brought into politics for the first time by the promise of Obama. I'm old enough to have gotten my heart broken in politics many, many times, and I don't want to overpromise for this guy. But I do think he has the potential to be a great president. And Roosevelt, I think, is the quintessential example of this. I mean, Roosevelt was able to touch something in the people and persuade the people that he was on their side. And so the 30s, after the quiescence of the 20s, the 30s was a period of all kinds of yeasty mass movements, some of which Roosevelt was kind of afraid of. But the combination of his leadership and the dire circumstances that he faced made the 30s a period of renewed activism. And I think you're going to see something like that in the next 4 to 8 years.
Yeah, Robert Kuttner, so I read your book. My sense was, and correct me if I'm mistaken, that it's really the times that sort of force Obama to find his inner angel, so to speak, or to rise to the level? Were he to assume the presidency in 1993 and luck into a stock market boom around the internet, he would not be a transformative president.
Yeah, I think no. That's exactly the point. And I should also say, not every crisis makes a great president. You know, Millard Fillmore faced the same gathering winds of slavery protest and the fact that the compromises that ultimately came apart in 1860 that Lincoln did. But the three or four presidents prior to Lincoln, none of them rose to the occasion. Hoover had 3.5 years of the Great Depression before Roosevelt beat him in 1932. He didn't rise to the occasion. Jimmy Carter had an energy crisis. He was a failed president.
You know, if I can stop you right there, because the first 33rd of the book, roughly, if not more, goes in great length through the successful presidencies, as you see it, the transformative presidencies of Lincoln, FDR, and Johnson with regard to civil rights. And then you also do take some time to talk about presidents who had the chance and who didn't rise to the occasion. And you talked about Jimmy Carter and his presidency. Maybe just say a few more words about that, since I think some of our listeners will well remember the Carter years.
Well, he did have the energy crisis and the crisis of stagflation, and he came to Washington as the consummate outsider. He'd been governor of Georgia for one term. He had very little feel for how you deal with Congress. That was one strike against him. He had very little feel for how you motivate ordinary people, and that was another strike against him. And he had bad economic advice. Well, three strikes and you're out. And he just, you know, and there was the famous or the infamous Malaz speech, where he basically gave a speech blaming the crisis on the American people, which was not particularly smart, and he fell on his face. So, and I think Clinton in some ways, even though he's remembered as a relatively successful president, I mean, his whole tenure was marked by moving the Democratic Party to the right, riding what turned out to be a stock market bubble and a housing bubble, embracing the idea of balanced budgets. He was the most conservative Democrat since Carter, who in turn was the most conservative Democrat since Grover Cleveland. And I liken Clinton to Typhoid Mary. I mean, he survived and everybody else got sick. So he wasn't good for his party, and I think over the long term he wasn't good for progressivism and wasn't terribly good for the country, even though there was the illusion that these were good times, but it was built on financial bubbles.
And I think he's had the advantage of being followed by someone who is, by virtually all accounts, not going to go high on the scorecard of historians as a president.
No. I want to say one other thing, if I may, before we turn to more calls, because I think this is crucial.
Okay.
My advice, and I'm not advising anybody, I mean, I'm just writing articles, but because of the rate at which this is unwinding, much more rapidly than the unwinding that occurred in 1929. My advice is that Obama and the Democratic leadership right now figure out what the emergency program is, and then on November 5th, when Obama becomes the de facto leader of the country, appeal to George Bush to at least go out on a high note and work with him. And specifically, I think they need to do three things that are much stronger medicine than they've done so far. First, they need to nationalize the banks, not all the banks, but some of the banks, and do what Fannie Mae, the FDIC does when a bank fails, and sort out the good assets from the bad assets, put civil servants who know what they're doing in there, which the FDIC knows how to do, not subcontract it to Goldman Sachs, for God's sakes. And that's what Paulson is doing. I mean, he's got a 35-year-old whiz kid who is exactly the kind of trader who got us into this mess, and he's put this kid in charge of the whole world economy. Then he's going to subcontract pieces of this rescue out to other investment banks. That's exactly backwards. So the government needs to do this. Secondly, we need to refinance mortgages directly. Rather than cleaning out some of these bonds, the government can use the Treasury's own borrowing rate to give people who got stuck with subprime loans and who are not speculators but who are owner-occupants, 4% mortgages and let them keep their homes. And third, we need an absolutely massive recovery program that involves government spending. Nancy Pelosi's talking about something on the order of magnitude of $250 billion. That's not a bad down payment. I think it's probably going to have to be two or three times that for the next few years in order to compensate for the shortfall of purchasing power, and so that states and cities and towns and counties don't start laying off public officials and deferring public works projects, which is the worst thing that you can do when you're on the edge of a depression. And so this could be the moment to recover the kind of New Deal, Great Society tradition that went off the rails in 1968 and has never really come back on the rails, and pick up where we left off, stop starving the public sector, get universal child care, get green redevelopment, get national health insurance, and take back the country from the far right.
Our guest, Robert Kuttner, who you've just been listening to, author of the new book, Obama's Challenge. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We're live today, so call in with questions. Our number, 333-9455, a toll-free number down. So if you're calling from outside the area, call 217-333-9455. Lots to talk about. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Are you afraid, even though I hope you're on target here, that your book could be dated on November 5 because of things like the Tom Bradley factor?
Well, I didn't mean to cut you off. Do you? I mean, I know exactly what you mean. Do you? Would you like me to respond, or do you have something further to come?
All right. Second point is I seem to think that Alan Greenspan, who's now come forward and talked about the horrific financial collapse we're in, what blame does he share in bringing about this situation? Finally, if you had the ear of Barack Obama, who would you suggest that he appoint as his Treasury Secretary?
That's great. Good
great
question.
Questions. Thank you very much, caller. Robert Kuttner?
First of all, Greenspan is going to go down in history as the worst chairman of the Federal Reserve ever because he was the one who combined very low interest rates with no regulation. And this is what created a bubble, which has now burst. And he was the guy when Congress was trying to regulate these exotic securities and bonds that nobody understood. He was the one who kept saying, the market knows what it's doing, keep your hands off. And he got an almost reverential treatment from the press when he was head of the Fed. There were very few of us who were dissenters, and I think we've been proven right. Secondly, the Bradley factor. I would like to believe that the country has become more tolerant, more mature, particularly people under 40, than it was when Mayor Bradley was ahead in the polls and then lost the election for governor of California. I think the polls within the Democratic Party, now granted the Democratic Party and its voters are not as bigoted as certain other parties we could mention, but a Democratic base does have a lot of socially conservative, white working class voters. But with a couple of exceptions, you did not see the Bradley phenomenon in the Democratic primary states where, you know, there's a 5 or 6 or 7 point difference between the last poll and what actually happens on election day. I also think to some extent the Bradley factor is offset by the cell phone factor, where younger voters who are more racially tolerant, more open, typically have cell phones and are underrepresented in the samples by pollsters who use old-fashioned landline numbers. So if I had a bet, I would bet that Obama does maybe a point or two worse than the final polling numbers. And right now he's up, depending on which poll you believe, 9, 10, 11, even 12 points, and continuing to pull away from McCain, and the McCain campaign is in total disarray. On the question of Treasury Secretary, there are two people who I respect enormously, and I've written this in the American Prospect. One is the head of the FDIC, a remarkable woman named Sheila Bair, B-A-I-R. She's from Kansas, and she is, of all things, a Republican. But she is the most progressive of all of the regulators, and she has used a failed bank that the FDIC took over called IndyMac, a $32 billion failed bank, as a kind of laboratory to show how the government can refinance people's mortgages and help them stay in their houses. It's an alternative to the approach that Paulson has pursued. So what a great appointment. I mean, a woman, a Republican, and somebody who's a genuine progressive. The other person I respect enormously is one of Obama's top advisors on the financial crisis. He's probably going to be the guy who turns out to be the architect of how you re-regulate this stuff, a guy named Dan Tarullo. And remember that name. Dan keeps a very low profile, but he's going to be very influential in the next administration.
Robert Kuttner, before we go back to the phone lines, and we have a couple of callers waiting patiently, I want to make sure you talk about one point, which I think is absolutely central to your argument and to your book, which is this whole question of budget deficits.
Yes.
Are they okay? Are they bad? And let me preface this again. I was just watching the Bill Maher program on HBO on Friday night, and he had, as his guest, a gentleman named David Walker.
Oh, the worst guy. I mean, he.
Well,
who
well, before, before you go into that, let me just tell you that Bill Maher, who's known for being a liberal and an Obama supporter, was praising David Walker for having the courage to sort of speak truth to power about how horrible the budget deficit is. And it struck me as I was watching Walker, and this is just as I was reading your book and you refer to Walker in there, that, you know, the Democratic Party has this obsession with balanced budgets that in many ways is much greater than the Republican Party.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was a tactic that kind of hardened into an ideology. That is, when Reagan and then Bush won, and then Bush II were spending like sailors, and not just spending like sailors on the military, but also cutting taxes on the rich, the idea of being the fiscally prudent party made a certain amount of tactical sense, because people thought that by being fiscally prudent, the Democrats could rein in some of the excesses on tax cuts for the rich and defense spending. Well, it didn't work. And now a lot of the Democrats are stuck with this idea that, hey, we need to be the party of budget balance. Now, it's true that at some point deficits can be dangerous, but we are nowhere near that point. And the last period that you need to worry about deficits during is a recession. And I'm sorry to be wonky, but let me offer some numbers.
Well, this is an important point, so please get a little wonky.
The national debt, which is the cumulative total of all prior deficits right now, is about 37% of 1 year's gross domestic product, all the output in the economy in 1 year. At the end of World War II, it was 120%. It was, you know, 3.5 times what it is relative to the size of the economy. And we came out of World War II. We had a 25-year boom. We had a 25-year boom where the benefits were distributed much more fairly than they are today. So if it takes 2 or 3 years of serious deficit spending and the debt goes up to 50 or even 55 or even 60% of GDP, it is no big deal. But if we have a 10-year Great Depression, that's a very big deal. So it seems to me that the deficit that Obama will inherit from Bush is going to be about 4 to 5% of GDP. If that goes up to 6 or 7% of GDP, that's fine. That's stimulative. But I also think that most of the additional public spending can be paid for. And how do you pay for it? By another one of these strange coincidences, the number that I picked on the additional public spending that we need just happens to be $700 billion. And when I wrote that in July, my editor said, my God, you know, no one's going to take that seriously. Well, here we are 2 months later, and the Republican Treasury Secretary has just gotten legislation through Congress for $700 billion worth of bailouts for Wall Street. So all of a sudden, that order of magnitude of government spending is not unthinkable, it's conventional. But my point is, if Wall Street gets its share in year one, then everybody else ought to get our share in years 2 through 8. And how do you pay for that? Well, if you restore the tax code that existed before Bush got hold of it, that's a couple of $100 billion. And if you restore the system of tax enforcement that exists, where audits are concentrated on rich people rather than on working class people who use the EITC, which is Bush's policy, you can get another couple of $100 billion that way. And then one very attractive idea is a very, very small tax on financial transactions, so that the person who is investing in the stock market for the long term hardly notices the tax, but the guy who is churning his account and the professional who is gambling with currency values and derivatives pays a fairly hefty tax. You could get another couple of $100 billion that way, and you could certainly get another couple of $100 billion by winding down the war and cutting unnecessary military spending. So you don't even have to rely very heavily on deficits to increase public spending in a way that benefits people. I do think that if the deficit goes up by maybe a point of GDP, that's fine. And I think the good thing is the last thing people are going to worry about for the next year or two is deficits. I mean, if Social Security has a slight shortfall in the year 2050, that's much less of concern than the country going into Great Depression 2 in 2009. And I do think most politicians are going to come to that same conclusion.
Our guest, Robert Kuttner, author of Obama's Challenge, joining us today live. The number here is area code 217-333-9455. We have several callers who've been waiting patiently. I'm going to try to get to all of you. Let's start right now with line two. Philo, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is that Bush said that if we cut taxes in a big way, we'd all get rich.
Didn't work.
It didn't work. And I'd like to have somebody respond to that. I haven't seen anybody respond to that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. I think you've made the call to the right person, since that is a subject you talk about, I think, quite at some length in your book, Robert Kuttner.
Well, it was totally self-serving for Bush's buddies. It didn't help ordinary people. And combined with deregulation, it just invited wealthy people to speculate. And this is the result.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now to line one. Sheldon, you're on the air with Robert Kuttner. Hello, Sheldon. Apparently, Sheldon is not with us any longer, so...
He's off checking his portfolio.
Sheldon, you there?
Yes.
You're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Hi, Robert.
Hi, Sheldon.
A few quick questions. Credit card interest rates, are 20% and more sometimes.
Mm.
And I heard on NPR that when a person misses a single payment, all the banks raise their rates.
Yeah.
That price fixing.
Credit card companies have a very cute scam going on. If you're 10 minutes late on your payment, they conclude that your credit rating has worsened, and then they jack up your interest rate.
Can't we do something about that?
You bet we can. We can make it illegal. And my former boss, Senator Proxmire, was the author of the Truth in Lending Law, and that was in the early 70s. We need to go back and redo it, because credit card companies and banks have found ways around it. Also, the credit card companies and the banks got a ruling out of the courts in the 70s allowing states to lift usury ceilings. And, it used to be against the law to charge mafia interest rates for credit cards. We need usury ceilings again. And I think because of the depth of the crisis, you're going to see a whole new period of pro-consumer regulation of the kind that most people are hungry for that has just been off limits under the Republicans.
Robert Kuttner, our guest today on Media Matters. You also are the editor-in-chief of The American Prospect. What is The American Prospect, and how can people learn about it?
Well, The American Prospect, I'm actually co-editor of The American Prospect, which I founded with Paul Starr and Robert Reich in 1989. The American Prospect is a progressive monthly magazine that also has a very lively website, www.prospect.org. And we try to be as left of center as you can be and still be mainstream and still influence mainstream politics.
And on the web, it's
www.prospect.org.
Prospect.org. Okay, great. You know, in the book, you make a strong case, as you've already started to do here, but I think a very strong case for the need for a huge public service or public expenses on infrastructure campaign, and as you said, hundreds of billions of dollars as the foundation of any sort of recovery effort. You also talk a lot about the importance of raising wage levels and steps to do that throughout the economy. And I think that's a very interesting discussion. And if you could just talk briefly about unions and the Employee Free Choice Act, that would be, I think, very enlightening to our listeners.
Well, you know, what's interesting about this financial crisis is that it is a credit disaster on top of 30 years of a slow decline in living standards and in economic security for ordinary people. And the decline occurred at a slow enough pace that it didn't trigger a real mass movement. And this was also the same period when business took off the gloves and really hammered the labor movement, It was a period when the Democratic Party moved to the right. So there's been a whole hunger that really hasn't found expression in a political movement for a more economically fair society. And a crisis can crystallize that sense of unease and give it voice and give it narrative. And one of the movements, I think, that is just waiting to burst back into flame is the labor movement. And the polls show that about one worker in two who is not currently a member of a union would like to join a union, but because companies play such hardball, if you try to organize a union, you'll probably lose your job, and the people who are at the National Labor Relations Board, by the time they get around to your case, you'll be long gone. So the Employee Free Choice Act basically says that if a majority of people who want a union sign cards, the union is automatically recognized. And Obama has committed to supporting that. I think he'll have a Democratic majority this time, and that should lead to a revival of the labor movement. But I also think that Obama has the power to valorize the labor movement, to point to the heroism of people who organize unions. I mean, Clinton, in his first State of the Union message to Congress, put Alan Greenspan in the front row sitting next to Hillary. How about if you have 20 men and women who organized a union sitting in the front row of the balcony and have the cameras pan in on them and have Obama pay homage to their bravery? Secondly, I think about 60% of all the money that goes to human service jobs is ultimately taxpayer money, and I'm talking about taking care of young kids, I'm talking about taking care of old people, taking care of sick people. And if you think about it, there are some good jobs in the human services. Doctor, good job. Nurse is a pretty good job. Public school teacher is a good job. But there are millions and millions of bad jobs that could be good jobs. Home care workers and people who don't have much training who take care of the elderly and people who work in daycare centers. And I think the government, with some of this $500 billion a year that I think we're going to need to dig out of the hole we're in, could have a policy that everybody who works in the human services gets paid as a professional. These are the jobs that can't be exported. They can't be outsourced. You got to do them at home. And people who don't have the training, you give them training on the job. You give them sabbaticals to go back to school. And so at the end of a few years, anybody who works in early childhood development, in a nursing home, can take home a paycheck that is sufficient to feel middle class and to be middle class. And, you know, you look at a union like the hotel and restaurant workers, now part of Unite Here, in the towns that they've organized, like Las Vegas, they took jobs that were really lousy jobs, and they turned them into middle-income jobs that have good benefits, good wages, good career advancement prospects. And you can do that with a whole service sector.
Our guest, Bob Cutner, author of Obama's Challenge. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champaign County. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Robert Cutner.
Hi. The union issue is extremely important, and also vis-a-vis the race, the Bradley factor that was brought up earlier. Trumka, who's being very vocal and is with the miners union, which was the most integrated union in its heyday, something like 30% African American. Is going to be on campus a couple of times this week, so people in the local area have the opportunity a couple of times to see him. You offered somebody as a suggestion for the cabinet, but how about ruling out some people like Rubin and maybe even your old buddy Robert Reich, because I think he was really seduced by this whole symbolic manipulation, symbolic worker discourse, which is just, to me, is just another way of saying derivatives are fine. I mean, I'm sure he would defend himself by saying he wouldn't have it unregulated and in the dark that we have this massive amount of money being transferred. And there was also something said earlier about how people don't have the ability to understand this, and I think that's selling Americans short. I don't think it's discussed enough so that people can't familiarize with it. so we don't hear enough about it, and I applaud the what you're bringing to the show. But one other thing, as just a little postscript, I know there's very little time, but the Tobin tax is coming up from the grassroots. It was offered a couple of weeks ago by a caller here, as opposed to anybody. And the idea of a financial transaction tax helping to pay for the bailout and maybe even some of the spending that is necessary, and maybe a high enough one on the derivative market that it would actually fold it up, because it's really a crapshoot. It's really like a casino, it seems to me, when you have that kind of betting without regulation. So I'll just hang up. Listen, I realize there's a little time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Bob Kuttner?
Great comments. I mean, I think that Obama would be very ill-advised, and I think he's probably unlikely to hire former Clintonistas. Robert Rubin was part of the problem. He was a Democrat, a Wall Street Democrat, who was an enabler and an advocate of deregulation. I mean, he came out of Goldman Sachs. He was a buddy of Paulson, so, you know, you can get your Goldman Sachs Democrat or your Goldman Sachs Republican, and that's called a two-party system. I certainly hope Obama's better than that. I'd be very surprised if anybody who was in the cabinet in the Clinton years is going to be in the Obama cabinet. I know that Larry Summers, for one, is running very hard for a second term of Secretary of the Treasury. But I think Obama's whole strategy of differentiating himself from Hillary Clinton and the Clintons generally was to say, turn the page, you know, that was that 90s show, let's have a fresh start. And I think he has to follow through on that.
You know, we have two callers patiently waiting I want to get to, but one question I want to ask you, Robert Kuttner, before we get to those calls. What about military spending? And, you know, are we at a moment where this economic crisis also signals we have to really do a rethink about the U.S. role in the world?
I sure hope so. I mean, I don't think Obama is going to be a radical on foreign policy. I do think he's committed to winding down the Iraq war as quickly as possible. He has talked about putting more troops into Afghanistan. I don't think that's totally crazy, by the way. I mean, if we had just concentrated on the Taliban and not had this adventurous war in Iraq, that would have been an appropriate targeting of foreign policy. He's certainly going to try and settle things in a constructive way with North Korea. He's got a lot of crises he's going to face. But, yeah, the Pentagon wastes a colossal amount of money. The idea of what our mission in the world is has been overly ambitious relative to what's either desirable or necessary or possible. And I think there's easily $150 to $200 billion that could be cut out of the defense budget. And, yes, that goes with a more modest role in the world.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. This is Media Matters. Our guest, Robert Kuttner, author of Obama's Challenge. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to first say thanks for clearing up a lot of this. It's a confusing situation. And, I guess my question is, with my limited understanding of the crisis that we're in right now, it seems pretty clear that government spending, you mentioned earlier, really needs to be spent on, like, ground-level solutions, reworking loans and preventing foreclosures. My question is, Congress was so quick to pass the bailout for big corporations, can you talk a little bit about these other types of solutions and maybe if there's things that we can be doing to give the bottom-up solutions a louder voice, a louder political voice?
Well, you know, someone...
Thank you very much, caller.
Yeah. One of the callers said this stuff is so damn complicated, people don't understand. Another caller said, well, actually, if we can talk about it some more, it's not that hard to understand. And I think one of the things that's very easy to understand is the difference between bailing out Wall Street and the difference between refinancing a distressed mortgage for a homeowner. And I think my spies tell me that the Democrats are right on the verge of giving serious consideration to passing that kind of a bill. So Congress needs to hear from folks big time. Refinance homeowners, don't bail out bondholders. I mean, you can do that in six words. And I also think that if Wall Street gets bailed out in year one, the rest of us ought to get some help in years two and hopefully through eight of the next administration. And I think because things have changed so radically, in a month, and it's possible to talk about $1 trillion for Wall Street, then it becomes possible to talk about $1 trillion for Main Street. And that's the conversation we ought to be having.
Robert Kuttner, real quickly, do you think that this book could be McCain's challenge, too? Could Maverick John McCain, who's been sort of talking some big talk about going after Wall Street, come in and propose and push through this sort of reform package?
I think it's very unlikely. I mean, first of all, I think it's very unlikely that he's going to get elected. Obama keeps gaining points almost every day. He's now up 10, 11 points in the poll, depending on which poll you believe. McCain has been kind of schizophrenic, and I think that's one of the reasons why his campaign is in such disarray. People don't know what he stands for. One day he tries to sound like a populist. The next day he's for cutting spending. The day after that he's for $300 billion of mortgage relief. He's all over the place. And, yeah, I would say the same one-liner that I would say if McCain, heaven forbid, got elected. He would either be a great president or a failed president. And because of the party that he comes out of, because of the ideology that he comes out of, he would be much less likely to apply the kind of medicine that's necessary, but it would be the same challenge. And it would be much harder because I think even in the unlikely circumstance that McCain wins the presidential, the Democrats are going to pick up seats in both houses. So he would face a Democratic Congress. You'd have a divided government. You would not have the ability to move quickly and boldly, and he's also talked about, you know, balancing the budget, and he really is all over the place, and I don't think he is prepared to do what's needed.
Let's take our last caller now. He's been waiting very patiently. Line one from the great state of Illinois. You're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Hi, my name's Jim. I hate to be the fly in the ointment here, but maybe I missed a couple of things here. The Depression, wasn't the Depression actually lasted longer because of this social nationalism that was instilled by Roosevelt, and the thing that got us out of the Depression was World War II. And actually, the main question I wanted to ask was when the banks were forced to loan to give these bad loans to people, what did you actually expect them to do but bundle them up and sell them back to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae?
Yeah, the banks were not.
You, caller.
This is a wonderful piece of right-wing mythology. The banks were not forced to give these bad loans to people, and most of the bad loans were originated by storefront mortgage companies that worked hand-in-glove with investment bankers. The vast majority of subprime loans were not made by federally regulated banks at all. So this is one of these great alibis that's floating around on right-wing talk radio. Secondly, the caller's correct that it took World War II to get us out of the Depression. Roosevelt got us about halfway out of the Depression. The unemployment rate was 25% in the winter of 1932. By the eve of World War II, it was down to about 12%, still much too high. And then we had the incredible wartime effort that involved deficits not of 3 or 4%, but of 20 or 30%. And we rebuilt the whole industrial might of the United States.
Robert Kuttner, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background, which regrettably means they want to throw me off the air and get me out of the studio. So let me take this opportunity to thank you, Robert Kuttner,
very much
for being our guest today. Robert Kuttner, the author of Obama's Challenge. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. I'm going to be back next week for a two-hour version starting at noon. So please be with us for two full hours with John Nichols and plenty of election coverage. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. See you all in 166 hours.